We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education. Today is February 24th, 2005, and we have a lot of stuff ahead of us today. So we're going to do a couple little housekeeping things and some information, and then I'll try to carry you through the agenda as we get started. But the beginning activity will be to introduce a committee bill. It's LC-3390. And to do that, I like to make sure that people understand this is an introduction as a committee bill. It has no indication as people vote up here whether they support or don't support this particular bill. It is just one way of introducing a legislative concept into the pool of bills that eventually committees will get. This one probably will come back to us. They don't have to. We could introduce anything. It's just that they have to get introduced either by an individual or by a committee, and so that's what we're doing. So with that, I would introduce, I will open a work session to entertain the motion to introduce a committee measure. With that, you want to?
Yes.
Okay. Then we'll have Senator Canope. Senator Gelser, do you want to say a few words about this introductory bill or not? Up to you. I think you.
Which bill is it?
This has to do with LC 3390.
So this is just a placeholder bill that comes out of some of the work we were doing on the other side around behavior support in schools and working towards collaborative problem solving to reduce difficult behaviors, reduce suspensions, reduce school discipline, and increase graduation rates.
So it is not in its final form in part, probably.
It is not.
Okay.
Very good.
It's a classic placeholder bill.
Chair Roblin, I move LC 3390, dated February 10, 2015, to be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Canope moves that LC 3390, dated February 10, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any work session? Is there any work session? I've got a work session. Is there any opposition to the introduction? Seeing none. So moved, and with that, we will close our work session on introduction of bills. And with that, we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 81, and we're going to have a beginning statement by Senator Haas. We do have a special guest, and he can talk a little bit about that, who will be Skyped into us. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your patience and indulgence and support. This is the Free Community College bill, for lack of a better phrase, and we've been, this is not a strange issue to the previous iteration of the Senate Education Committee. We've been working on it for more than a year. The state has studied it, and it's sort of the Oregon way to do that. And I know from talking to people in this building and all over the state that there's quite a bit of support for it. And I also know that, as we queue up our Skype feed here, in our palm game.
Right.
Hi, Professor.
Hi, I'm back.
Oh, okay. We're really lucky to be joined by one of the more prominent experts on college affordability who's been helping the Department of Education back in Washington, D.C., and her name is Sarah Goldgrab. She's a professor at Wisconsin and has become the preeminent speaker on this issue of college affordability, and she has the ear of the White House and travels all over the country. Mostly what she does is she teaches college students, but because of her expertise, she travels around the country and sometimes travels out to Oregon, where we met a couple of times over this past year, and she helped us with our program, and we've invited her to come and speak to our committee about Senate Bill 81 and larger than that, some of the benefits of what community college will do for our younger people and the opportunities that it creates. I have a statement that I'll pass out to the committee and made some copies there, and I won't read it into the record, but I just wanted to toss it over to Professor Goldrick-Rabb and say thank you, Professor, for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to join you all, and I have to tell you, I really wish that I could have been there with you in person. I've enjoyed traveling to your state and getting to know the folks involved in this process. I think it's wonderful that you all are deliberating in the ways that you are about post-secondary education, and I think that it's a really good time for Oregon to be having this discussion. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm hoping you all can hear me just fine all the way here from Madison, Wisconsin. So I'm going to speak a little bit based on what I've learned over... Say again?
For our testimony, can you make sure that you identify who you are for the record?
Yes, I will be happy to do so. Thank you. I'm Sarah Goldrick Rabb. I'm a professor of educational policy studies and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I have spent the last 15 years or so now studying ways to make college more affordable. I do this in many different ways. First of all, I talk to people who are actually involved in making those decisions, those difficult choices about what to pay for college, where to go. So I do talk to students and I talk to parents, and I do so in very rigorous ways over long periods of time and in in-depth conversations. I also spend a lot of time talking to schools, talking to both faculty but also administration, those who make budgetary decisions, the presidents, the trustees, and I consider the ways in which the resources that they have and their capacity to educate students affects their ability to do a high-quality job with students. I have had the opportunity, as the senator said, to work both in Washington and also with multiple state governments as well, and I very much recognize that the situation that you all are in Oregon, is in some ways different from in other states, but in many ways very similar. I fully support the bill that has been put forward today. And let me tell you a little bit about why. I believe that this bill is a bold effort that frankly might not have been necessary 20 years ago, but today is sorely needed. There is a popular perception out there, and many of you may have heard it in your conversations, that community college is already free or nearly free. And that this is particularly true for students from low-income households. You might have also heard that the real challenges that face these students today have more to do with academic underpreparation or informational barriers. And you might be wondering, if this is so, why would the senator be introducing a bill like this? Isn't this something that we don't need at this point, and aren't there better things to do? Well, the problem is that these are statements and perceptions that unfortunately are not grounded in today's reality. The average out-of-pocket cost facing Oregon community college students from low-income families and moderate-income families today ranges from $8,000 to $11,000 per year. That's after all grant aid is already taken into account, after all scholarships have been received. And therefore, it represents the amount of money that students must borrow and earn, and typically they need to do both borrow and work, in order to make college possible. The situation, frankly, facing moderate-income families, those who are just above that Pell Grant threshold, is not much better. And in fact, I argue that it's a difficult situation, since they have very little disposable income, and yet they can't access the federal Pell Grant. Now, 30 years ago, high schools and policymakers around the country were focusing on helping more students to envision college as part of their future. That's not to say, for the record, that the point was ever to make everyone go to college, but rather to get more people to think about continuing their education after high school so that they could be better prepared for a workforce and a life that will involve critical thinking skills, communication skills, and the sorts of things that are required in today's world. Two decades ago, 20 years ago, we then shifted from not only talking about college, but really trying to get students academically prepared for college. And as we all know, raising high school graduation rates and trying to get students college ready is something that we continue to work on today. But the fact is that today there are ambitious, academically prepared high school graduates who are attending college and leaving without degrees, because they can't afford to persist. There are also some students who are academically prepared from low-income families who forego college entirely. They don't go anywhere. And this is about 20% of high school graduates from the bottom family income brackets. And about 30% of those who started a two-year college, like your community colleges, never receive a degree. Those rates of non-completion have everything to do with affordability, and they signal talent loss. And things, frankly, have gotten a lot worse over the last decade. So for those reasons, this bill will benefit low and moderate income students in real and measurable ways. I believe that the research indicates that it will increase their rates of enrollment in college, it will boost their persistence rates, and it may also increase the graduation rates. Rigorous studies, including a recent one from Texas, has shown that reducing the cost of attending community college by even $1,000 a year results in substantial increases in the outcomes I just described across the board. More low-income students enroll directly from high school. More low-income students who otherwise would not have enrolled do enroll. More of them transfer to four-year colleges. And for the students who wouldn't have enrolled, except for the fact that you made community college more affordable, they become 20% more likely to earn a bachelor's degree within 8 years of high school graduation. All that for a $1,000 discount located at the community colleges that doesn't even involve the public four-year sector. That's a good deal. So certainly, some students who do not currently receive financial aid will benefit from this plan, and some might critique it for that. But you need to remember that today's financial aid system overlooks a tremendous amount of real financial need. My colleague Andrew Kelly at the American Enterprise Institute and I recently authored a book called Reinventing Financial Aid, in which we detail this. It came out from Harvard Press, and it shows you repeatedly that today's financial aid system is not something that we should be struggling to maintain or even necessarily worried that we would contradict, because it's incredibly inadequate. What we want to do is do better than it. And there are benefits of a universal approach like the one you're proposing that extend beyond the impacts on today's students. It also sends powerful signals to the potential students of tomorrow, the students who today are entering kindergarten and first and second grade. Those are the students who are really going to hear your message. Now, could the proposed policy be strengthened to be even more effective? Certainly, couldn't any policy. Of course, I think it would be far better if it mirrored President Obama's proposed approach in serving as a first dollar rather than last dollar scholarship. But that's nearly impossible for Oregon to accomplish without federal help, which has not been forthcoming. It would be preferable to include public four-year colleges and universities in the plan so that financially constrained students would have even more choices, but it would probably be more expensive. And ideally, you would invest to complement this effort with more supports for their academics and social supports, so that community college students would have a more robust management portfolio, comprehensive case management as they move through college. But let's be real, you have to start somewhere. And I applaud you for the step to have this discussion. Supporting more hardworking people of Oregon as they seek your very fine community colleges and helping more of those who start their degrees finish them. That, I believe, is a very sound investment in your state's future. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
So, questions? Senator Hess.
Well, yeah, first, let me reiterate my appreciation, Dr. Goldrick-Rapp, for helping us with this bill, and your expertise is literally inside this bill. You epitomize part of the problem here with your phrase, the kids who don't go anywhere. And we have about 70,000 of those kids in what one of our agencies calls opportunity youth, between the age of 24, and they are not bad kids. They are not criminals or anything like that. They're just not going anywhere. And this is an opportunity to nudge them along. And I was just wondering if you've seen the Tennessee project, the effect that's having on this population, because Oregon, of course, isn't the only state with this population. I wish Oregon could have beaten Tennessee to be first with this, but there are some benefits to having a state go in front of this. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. Well, yes, Tennessee did get out first, and they got out fast. I want to say something about that group you're talking about. You know, it's right now we can talk about them as kids because they're still young. But I think one of the reasons that we have to be so concerned with them is that they're not going to be kids for much longer. They're going to become adults. And as they become adults, and some of them already are, frankly, they didn't have much of a childhood coming from a very low-income background, they are going to face some very difficult situations out there, both in the job market, in terms of the opportunities that are available to them, and the things that they will turn towards if they don't have opportunities that make their lives meaningful and worth living. The things that they will turn to do will cost this state money in the long haul. So that's where being forward thinking will pay off. Now, what Tennessee has seen is very large enrollment increases. So they have seen a great deal of interest in the number of people who are applying. I have to admit, we don't know that much yet about exactly who these people are and in terms of what their demographics are, et cetera. But we do know that we saw a fair sizable enrollment, I believe, of students from low-income families and racial ethnic minority students in particular. And I think this is what we would expect. And you're right, following in their footsteps will allow you to do some better planning. It will provide you with some numbers that you might help your colleges in terms of anticipating what their capacity for their enrollment, you know, will need to be and allow them to project. And it will give them colleagues in Tennessee to speak with during that planning process.
Thank you. I've passed out some news stories about the response in Tennessee. And the one thing I noticed, Professor, is that new law down there in what is really kind of a red state, I think, has really helped their mojo. And it's made them feel better about being Tennesseans, I guess. And you can't quantify or put that kind of feeling into budgetary calculus. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you can't. And I want to tell you all, you know, one of the biggest and most exciting parts about all of this is that we're part of a really important historic moment, right? If you look back to when higher education got its big federal boost, right, in the Higher Education Act of 1965, this is the 50th year anniversary, okay? And that kicked off all of this, you know, real investment and interest in college going. This is about taking that to the next level in very much the same way that we did in the middle to late parts of the 19th century when we began to talk about making free public high school. And please note, this process was not rapid. It took from the time that Horace Mann started talking about doing it, it took almost 80 years until that was achieved. That was money lost in the economy. It was, of course, happening during a period of great turmoil in this country. But we can all see how important it has been that our children are not working in factories and in the fields, but they are, in fact, in school. And we all know what that has generated in terms of a knowledge economy. The ending of high school with 12th grade is a bit of a random decision. There is really nothing particularly different about 13th year of education versus the 12th. And there's no real reason to think that 13th and 14th years could not become incorporated into our free schooling system in much the same way that we incorporated high school when it was just middle school before that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions for Dr. Goldrath? I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us here today and to it's nice to meet one of the people who helped spur our previous chair to take this on as one of the opportunities he saw necessary for the state of Oregon. So, again, thank you for your participation today.
I appreciate it. Good luck.
Yep. Bye-bye. We're going to open a public hearing or informational hearing with Ben Cannon, Executive Director. So we're going to leave this open. We're going to have Ben do his presentation, then we'll come back to Senate Bill 81. So I'll open the informational hearing. And Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Glad to be back. And I think I can do this presentation in about 10 minutes uninterrupted, but interruptions also welcome too. My goal today in this informational context is to provide a view of affordability, college affordability, that hopefully can inform your deliberations on the important bills in front of you today, as well as others before your committee. So I won't be addressing the bills specifically, but trying to sort of unpack some of the dimensions of affordability that sometimes get lost in conversations that tend to focus mainly on tuition. So I want to start by taking on affordability from the standpoint of, I think, a student or a family member, a concern for the student, perhaps paying for the student. And I really think there are three primary questions for a student who's thinking about spending money for college. One of them is, of course, what will I spend? What will that cost be? A second is, what am I going to earn as a result? And third, how will it pay off? How will that degree, certificate, or experience pay off? So could describe this as cost, outcomes, and earnings. And what I'm going to continue to walk through here is, to be clear, a very simplified view of affordability, but hopefully a helpful construct. So I'm going to take four representative students, again, highly simplified, and just attempt to discern whether these experiences would be considered or could be considered affordable. So let me talk about the first student. So let's just imagine a student for whom the cost is high. And I want to just stop at that point and describe what I mean by cost. Cost for a student is not simply tuition. And we all understand that. It's tuition plus fees plus books plus living expenses. And I'm describing it here as also minus whatever grants or scholarships the student receives. So cost, first of all, more than tuition. And let's just suppose that the cost for the student is high. And let's also go on to say that the student doesn't complete the certificate or degree. And not surprisingly, as a result, the earnings are low. We would clearly put this in the category of a student for whom the experience was unaffordable. This is the worst case. This is what we're trying to avoid at all costs. And unfortunately, it's an experience that too many of our students have. Our second student here also has a high cost experience, understood as tuition, living expenses, minus grants and scholarships, but earns a degree, and let's just suppose that their earnings are high as a result. And for this student, the experience may be affordable. It, of course, depends on whether those earnings really do support the debt that the student has likely incurred as a result. But this is also a common experience for Oregon students attending our colleges and our public universities, where notwithstanding the high cost that they invested on the front end, their success at the institution and their success in the workforce makes it, by most measures, an affordable experience. I think our best case, of course, is this in this overly simplified view, is our third student. Let's imagine, suppose, a community college student with a relatively low-cost experience, perhaps living at home and reducing costs that way, earning a certificate or degree that pays off in the workforce, and we would clearly describe this as affordable. And finally, there may be students for whom the cost is low. Combination of tuition, living at home, lowers the price, but without a degree, without commensurate earnings, despite the fact that their cost on the front end was low, it may not be truly an affordable experience. Those costs still don't pay off. So this is a complicated equation. Affordability is not as simple as it might seem on the surface. A few key takeaways. Tuition is not the entire story. High price does not equal necessarily unaffordable. And outcomes and earnings matter. A little bit of background data, and this is just for our public universities. It only reflects tuition and fees, not other costs, but we see the trend here. You all know this story, nearly a doubling over the last decade and a half. The green line here reflects one form of state support for students, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, that has been largely flat over that time period. The growing gap between what students pay and their opportunities to offset that through scholarships is a problem for affordability. This is an interesting slide that disaggregates debt by race ethnicity, although what I want to focus on in this data is not the racial or ethnic dimensions here, but rather the way in which the average debt for Oregon University System students at graduation increases significantly depending on whether it takes them 4 years, 5 years, or 6 years to complete their degree. So the green bars here on any of these racial or ethnic groups represent students who completed their degree in 4 years. The light blue bars, the teal bars, represent students who took 6 years, not four, and there's the five in between. The story here is that time to degree matters significantly. And as you know, we have a lot of students for whom 4 years, it takes more than 4 years. They're in this 5 or 6 year category, and they exit with significantly more debt. Efforts like ensuring that more students come to college already with college credit under their belt can help reduce the time to degree and help move more students into the 4 year graduate category and not the six year category. Completion rates also matter, and this historical data shows the small improvement in our graduation rate at our public universities, but still a long way to go, with 60% of students who enter Oregon public universities completing at any Oregon public university within 6 years. There's a lot of data to share related to graduation rates at community colleges, at public universities, at students who go from one to the other. But part of the way I would suggest, and our commission would suggest, that we think about affordability is also in terms of completing this or improving these completion rates and impacting the likelihood of success as a result. Higher education is a good investment, and for those who succeed and those who can do it in a reasonable period of time. This is, again, familiar data that illustrates the conventional wisdom that greater levels of education are associated, on average, with higher earnings, helping, again, just to reinforce the case that if you earn a degree, you're going to earn more in the marketplace as a result. And so the greater costs that those students bear may, again, it depends on a lot of things, but may, in fact, pay off. This slide really helps to illustrate a similar point. This is, obviously you can't see the detail along the bottom. We've provided this for your closer scrutiny as well. But this is a list of fields on the bottom, or more major areas. And it shows earnings for graduates in those areas from our public universities 1 through 5 years after graduation. So this is an expression of the type of data that the state of Oregon, through the commission, can provide to begin to tease out, okay, we know that degrees make a difference for earnings. Certain types of degrees appear to make a greater difference than others. I don't think there's any big takeaway from this slide specifically. The big spike, not surprisingly, is around engineering degrees and computer science degrees. We actually see in data, when we look beyond 5 years, that there starts to be a leveling off, and there's greater acceleration in earnings for some of the other fields listed here, where engineering and computer science flatten somewhat. So that premium, that earnings premium that they earn, comes particularly in the first years after graduation. Nevertheless, we can use this type of data to help make our policy decisions, or help inform our policy decisions about investments in higher education and support for students as they choose paths through higher education. So just to conclude with sort of the what I hope are some key takeaways: cost is not simply tuition. High cost does not necessarily equal unaffordable. We have to think beyond tuition to aid, state and institutional and other forms of aid, to completion, to time to completion, to the type of certificate, degree, or major that the student chooses, and to their earnings beyond graduation. There are two additional slides here that I won't spend a lot of time with, but I've included for your consideration. The headline in grabbing data relative to debt, you know, when we hear about students with hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even $50,000, $80,000, daunting levels of debt, the data indicates that's typically correlated with graduate degree programs. So maybe business programs, maybe medical programs, maybe veterinary programs. And so the data that I provided sort of provides, I think, a better sense of where debt is concentrated. And we see much less of it concentrated at the undergraduate AA and certificate level. I'll conclude.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cannon? Seeing none. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. So we're going to close our informational meeting, and we have already opened Senate Bill 81. And to start us off, I don't see Representative Reed, but we'll hope that he gets here fairly soon because he was here a second ago. And
I'll text him.
And we'll have Senator Hass. So call them first.
Mr. Chair, I know we've been working on this for a long time, and I know it's a popular concept, especially in some of the rural areas, to give their kids some opportunity that they used to have when they would walk out of the high school and into a lumber mill. And those days are long gone. And so I know it's a popular concept to provide these opportunities. What we're really debating, I think, here is the best mechanics to make this happen. And I also know there's some hand-wringing about this from universities, from people who are nervous anytime you want to change the status quo. So I'd like to read a quote. Colleges and universities will find themselves converted into educational hobo jungles. This is a threat to American education. Education is not a device for coping with unemployment. That's a quote from a university president in 1950 to the creation of the GI Bill. A program that is probably the most successful educational program in the history of the world. So I hope this hand-wringing, if you have a better way to do this, we're all ears. We're open to considering any and all suggestions to make this program a success, but what we don't need is talk about how we can't do this in creating hobo jungles. We're not interested in hearing about that. So I see our good colleague, Representative Reed, is here to join us.
And I think Dr. Brown can come on up and sit with here as well.
Okay.
Thank you. So with that, it's great to have you here, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I'm sorry for the delay. I'm just a couple of rooms down the hall in the Revenue Committee where we're talking about a variety of other issues. I really appreciate your willingness to hear the bill and the concept. I'm glad to have been in the room for Dr. Goldrick-Rabb's testimony as well. I was fortunate to be in the room for a couple of her visits to Oregon. I think she did a great job. A lot of the things that I was going to say have been mentioned already. I'd particularly point to that number of young people who are struggling. 67,000 to 70,000 people has been mentioned. We have a goal in Oregon to make sure that 80% of people have at least an associate's degree by 2025, and that's one of the reasons that it's so important. I think this bill it represents a new approach to financing post-secondary education. It recognizes the range of things that are good opportunities for people. And that's part of who we are as Oregonians and Americans, giving people a chance to live up to their full potential. But this bill matters for another important reason. Even if you're not persuaded that that's part of who we are, these folks without those opportunities are expensive for us. The Youth Council estimates that the average cost to taxpayers for each one of these young people is somewhere around $14,000 a year in social services and direct costs. So when the person has an opportunity as a result of the education that this bill makes possible, that those dollars and those costs come off the books. And considering that tuition is somewhere around $3,500 a year, I think that's a pretty good investment. I really want to just encourage you to think about this, as I'm sure you already do, in the same vein as our other national security challenges, because I think that's what it is. When we're not giving people these opportunities, it cuts at one of the best advantages this country has. It's also a real problem for our economy. The amount of student debt that's owed by Americans is staggering. Every time you hear about credit card debt and how overwhelming that can be, remember that the amount of student debt that's owed is more. And when people are having to deal with those costs, they're not doing things that circulate money throughout the rest of the economy. They're not buying homes. They're not buying cars. They're not making the expenditures that help our economy go. You've already heard, of course, that we're not first on this idea. Tennessee and Mississippi are looking at this. but I don't want us to be any farther behind. I think it's certainly not the only answer or the only solution, but it's something we should be working hard on in conjunction with the other things that address the cost drivers in higher education. And I can say, as the chair of the House Committee on Higher Education, we are eager for your good work on this bill, and we'd love to have it in the House. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Dr. Brown, we'll go with you first, and then we'll ask questions if people have any.
Thank you very much. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Jeremy Brown, president of Portland Community College. I've been invited here today to give you my thoughts on Senate Bill 821. I'd like to start by thanking Senator Hess for his strong support of community colleges, especially Portland Community College. He's been an advocate for access and affordability for students, as well as being committed to achieving academic excellence. It's clear that he's not afraid to champion bold ideas, and I applaud him for his vision. Through five decades of growth, PCC has evolved into Oregon's largest post-secondary institution of higher education, providing unmatched access to the region's broadest array of educational resources. Yet we've always remained true to the fundamental principles that have long defined our culture, our deeply felt commitment to accessibility, affordability, diversity, innovation, opportunity, partnerships, and sustainability. With federal and state support shrinking, tuition rising, and families still recovering from the recession, community colleges provide the best hope for access to quality, affordable college education. Whether enrolled for credit toward a degree or a certificate, pre-college coursework or professional or workforce development, access to affordable, high-quality education can open up new opportunities and provide the motivation for the realization of dreams for students in all stages of life and from all backgrounds. Yet many students are struggling to stay in school due to lack of resources. Affordable education remains a top priority for PCC. Indeed, just last week, we heard from many concerned students at PCC regarding the rising cost of their education. So I'm pleased to see the legislature is also taking this issue very seriously. I would also like to thank Senator Hess for reaching out to community colleges for input on this important initiative. The changes he has made in the Dash 1 amendment address many of the concerns expressed to him. I would like to discuss a few of these elements of the amendment that I see as extremely important. First is the requirement that all students receiving a tuition waiver must complete and submit the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA form. Too much federal money is being left on the table that students desperately need. This requirement will provide greater incentive to those who want to access those resources. Second is adding an academic advising requirement. We know funding students will not be enough to get them through to graduation. We know that with significant student support, we are able to dramatically improve retention and completion rates. We have seen this at PCC through programs like Future Connect that use a college success coach model to support students from start to finish. Student support is a crucial element to student success. Finally, as I read the Dash 1 amendment, it addresses one of our most serious concerns, and that is how this bill will be funded. As I read the Dash 1 amendment, it preserves the authority of the community college boards to set tuition and provides a mechanism for reimbursement to community colleges for the tuition that is being waived. A waiver to students without parallel support for community colleges would make this almost unworkable. It is absolutely necessary if we are to maintain the quality of education. I recognize that this initiative comes with a price tag and that this is difficult to accomplish with the available resources. However, by limiting the eligibility to students who have graduated within the past 2 years, we are significantly reducing the impact of this initiative. The average age of a PCC student is around 29. Only around 12.5% of PCC students taking classes for credit would qualify under the proposed guidelines. We are proud to be a place where students of all ages come to improve their lives and the lives of their families. I encourage further consideration to make this program available to students of all ages. Another concern is for our lowest income students, who will not benefit from this program, but are the students perhaps at most risk of dropping out due to lack of financial resources. As we all know, the cost of attending college is much more than tuition. Students who receive a full Pell Grant would receive no assistance from this program, as is currently envisioned. These full Pell students often struggle to maintain housing and transportation and sometimes go hungry. I would like to suggest that bill be structured in a way that will also provide Pell students with additional state support, perhaps with a matching grant up to a certain limit. The idea of debt-free education is now a source of national dialogue. In Oregon, we are one of the leaders in this thinking, and I'm delighted to see this discussion command such a high level of prominence. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Questions from our committee?
Just make a comment. I'd say,
Senator Hass.
Dr. Brown, thank you for your support of this concept, and you know, we too would like to expand this to more people and housing for full, but we're flying coach here, and to keep the price tag in that no frills category, you know, we had to draw the line somewhere. And as the professor said earlier, this is a good start, and we know this is not going to eradicate poverty, it's not going to solve world hunger or save the world. It's just one of about a dozen or so things in education that we should do. So many thanks to you and for PCC in general, especially over the last 5 years during this recession when your institution's kind of been the workhorse of higher ed in this state. And it's been understaffed and working at full throttle, and very much appreciate that.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Couple of things, Mr. Chair. Does this bill have subsequent referral?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It will, yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, it does say where the community colleges are going to get their money. It doesn't say where the heck's going to get their money. honestly, when we look at, for example, at the K-12 budget as currently constructed, it is woefully deplete in some areas, and we do have a finite pot of money. So I'm just saying this is going to be an interesting puzzle to put together.
Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
There's no one else who has signed up to speak to this bill. If there is anyone who didn't get their name on the list that would like to speak,
put minor problem right.
Now is the time.
A million here.
Seeing no one, we're going to. Oh,
there,
come on up. And make sure you give us an explanation of who you are at the same time you're giving your testimony.
Senator Roblon, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Dentz, professor of political science at Eastern Oregon University and president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. We represent the faculty of Oregon's public universities. IFS firmly believes in the centrality of the overarching principles of access and affordability in the pursuit of the state's ambitious 40-40-20 goals and the future of the state of Oregon. However, there are a series of problematic technical issues with Senate Bill 81 that inhibit its potential effectiveness. First, the current draft of Senate Bill 81 does not address the significant increase in the cost of student fees at Oregon's community colleges. While there are HEC-based safeguards in place to limit annual increases in student tuition costs at public universities, there is no corresponding procedure to limit increases in student fees at community colleges. Without additional protective measures, students receiving the benefits of community college tuition waivers under Senate Bill 81 may in fact confront an increase in the net price of their education. The omission of a procedural safeguard to control student fee increases adversely affects the potential access and affordability benefits of Senate Bill 81. Second, the language in Senate Bill 81, which requires students to have, quote, accepted all state and federal aid grants available to the person, end quote, may adversely affect student ability to complete their baccalaureate degree in a timely fashion. given the maximum amount an individual can receive in federal Pell Grant aid over their lifetime. This provision may leave students without adequate financial aid resources to complete their undergraduate degree. The termination of financial aid support before degree completion can trigger a virulent cycle of debt, which adversely affects student lives, along with impairing attainment of the state's 40-40-20 goals. Finally, one of IFS' guiding precepts is ensuring academic quality in higher education in Oregon. Given the potential for a significant increase in the number of Oregonians attending community college due to the proposed tuition waiver provisions of Senate Bill 81, IFS is concerned academic quality, as measured by class size and a number of other metrics, will invariably suffer, leaving students underprepared to successfully complete their undergraduate education. IFS firmly believes in the precepts of access and affordability for higher education and supports the state's 40-40-20 goals. However, Senate Bill 81 may leave the state holding a significant and underfunded fiscal obligation, which has the potential to adversely affect adequate funding levels for higher education. The above series of potential unintended consequences linked to Senate Bill 81 requires a more comprehensive solution for Oregon's community colleges. Thank you for your time. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
And did that include the issues in the Dash 1 amendments as well? Have you seen those?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Chair Roblin and members of the Senate Committee on Education, my name is Dr. Jose Padin. I am elected president of the Oregon Conference of the American Association of University Professors, and my work as elected president of the Oregon AUP Conference is volunteer service on behalf of our students in our universities. I am an associate professor of sociology at Portland State University, and I've been an Oregon educator for 19 years. And on behalf of the Oregon Conference of the AUP and our faculty chapters at the University of Oregon, Portland State University, and our members across the state of Oregon, I'm here to express some concerns about SB 81. We share with the authors of SB 81 a belief that debt-free, high-quality public education is a public good and is something we ought to strive for. But I do welcome the opportunity to share some misgivings to try and refine the idea and the concept behind this bill. Our first concern is that even with the amendment, it appears that SB 81 is not fully funded yet. And if this is the case, then without a clear source of new funding, SB 81 would come at the expense of programs at community colleges, colleges and universities, or cost could be shifted onto students or a mix of both. I'm not quite sure. Maybe that concern has been fully answered, but we just wanted to flag it because we haven't been able to figure out for ourselves whether it has been answered. The second concern that we have in regards to SB 81 is that it is discriminatory. In Oregon, we have built a public higher education infrastructure over decades, and community colleges are a vital part of that public higher education infrastructure. But we also have undergraduate programs of state, regional, and national repute at the four-year institutions. And SB 81 disadvantages those students for whom the programs at four-year institutions might be the best choice. And if the concept behind SB 81 were fully funded, we just want to raise the question, shouldn't it be non-discriminatory? Shouldn't we allow our students to use their 2 years of free tuition at any public university? Senator Haas, I really appreciate your bringing up the historical parallel to the GI Bill, because I do believe that the GI Bill was something that a GI was able to take at any institution, not only to 2 year institutions, and I think we ought to aim for that as we replicated here. Our third concern is that SB 81 would have an unintended consequence of siphoning students from the 4 year institutions over to community colleges, and this would depress enrollment in our 4 year institutions. Now, universities will be forced to shift the cost onto years 3 and 4 of the bachelor's degree, and this is going to affect completion rates. And universities will also be forced to start chasing out-of-state students, crowding out Oregonians in the search for out-of-state tuition. This is not an intended consequence. It's an unintended one, but it's one worth flagging. So for these reasons, it seems that in some ways, at the time when the state is attempting to move towards the 40-40-20 goals, SB 81, without refining these points, might undermine progress in that direction. So in sum, we believe that in the concept behind SB 81, we believe in the idea of debt-free, accessible, high-quality higher education for Oregonians and for Americans in general, but we do believe that these funds ought to be usable at any public institution of higher education, and we ought to redouble efforts to make sure that it is fully funded. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you for coming. First, thank you very much for engaging and testifying today. I would respectfully disagree with most of what you said. In fact, I think some of what you said was just erroneous, and I'd be happy sometime when we have more time to refute every point you made. What I find most problematic, though, is we've been working on this for almost 2 years, and this is the first time that you've engaged or come before a task force or an interim committee or a full committee with any kind of comment. So let's just comment for the day.
Senator Hess, just for the record, when we were here last time, I informed that the Oregon Conference of the AUP is a new conference, so it did not exist in the state of Oregon in any prior legislative session, so our absence is explained by that.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Haas, Senator Roblin. IFS has a tradition of leadership changing on an annual basis, and this has been my first opportunity to engage. Previously, IFS is not engaged in legislative affairs, and given my political science background, I've chosen to take a more aggressive path. I think the real issue for us is the student fee issue. If we try to track over time tuition increases vis-a-vis student fee, we see increased debt placed on students with regard to a tremendous increase in student fees, and we'd like to see that addressed as part of the legislation. We do believe in access and affordability, but student fees are significantly contributing to student debt.
Senator Bischer.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Could we perceive that maybe students in our four-year universities may move down to community colleges to take advantage of this program?
Good morning. Senator, Chair, thank you for your query. There is a significant reverse transfer available in Oregon, so it is potential. I wonder if a survey might help enlighten the committee in terms of proper funding with regard to the path that you mentioned.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Again, anybody else who did not sign up who would like to testify on Senate Bill 81? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 81. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 84. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 84 establishes statewide standards and funding mechanisms for accelerated college credit programs for high school students. This may have a fiscal and revenue impact, but statements have not been issued at this time. We are considering the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 amendments.
Okay. And with that, we're going to invite Dr. Nancy Golden and Hilda Rosaline.
Senator Roblin, I've seen you many times today.
So
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden and I'm the Chief Education Officer. I'm thrilled that we're talking about Senate Bill 222 today, because Senate Bill 222 is about how do you accelerate getting college credits in high school. When I think of the previous conversation, really what we're looking for is more opportunities for students to get college credit, and certainly Senate Bill 222 provides opportunities. So, Senate Bill Senate Bill 84, I apologize. Okay. It was originally Senate Bill 222, which brought together a legislative committee who worked for over a year to come up with a proposal that has become Senate Bill 84, so I apologize for that. When we talk about the Oregon Education Investment Board, we know we have outcomes we're trying to achieve. Accessibility and completion are two of the very important outcomes that really will complete that pathway so our students can become prosperous in our state as well. So I want to talk a little bit about what Senate Bill 84 does. It creates a seamless system, an equitable pathway for every Oregonian student. And it's really meant to be a collaborative culture of engaging K-12 and post-secondary education together to create college-level courses in high school. Now, I can tell you as a superintendent, many of our kids left going to college with a number of credits, sometimes even a year. But if we look across the state, there's over 100 districts, at least 100 districts, where none of the students have an opportunity to get college credit in high school. So that is what this bill is really about. So what Senate Bill 84 does is it establishes statewide guidance and funding mechanisms to ensure that every student will get at least 9 college credits in high school, and these are generally what we refer to as dual credit courses. It also will allow them to get credits for advanced placement and international baccalaureate courses. So what does this really accomplish on behalf of our students? The first thing it does is it provides the opportunity for underserved students to have an opportunity to get classes in high school. They might be the first in their family to ever go to college. They might not come from college-going cultures. And when they have an opportunity to be exposed to going to college or having a college course, they decide they want to do it. What this also does is it has us work to make sure that the college credits that students receive in high school are rigorous college credits, and that they will be accepted by all of the universities. I've had experience of kids saying, I got college credit, but they show up at a university, and they're told, well, those were nice credits, but they don't count here. So we want these to count towards their degrees. In addition to that, we also want these to count toward technical education degrees. We know those are a set of degrees or certificates that are critically important. I spoke about this before. But it also, what it also accomplishes is an opportunity for families to understand how to get access to college going. I have to say, even as a person whose my whole life has been in education, when my daughter applied to college, I thought I was going to have to take a leave from my job to really do everything you need to do to complete the applications, figure out where you want to go, what the majors are. So access is really critical, so that people have the information, the tools, and the perspectives to enhance access to post-secondary education. We also know that we want to address the shortage and the approval process limitations for having high school teachers teach college courses. I'm sure you've heard, I've heard when I go around the state, that it's very difficult for high school teachers in many cases to be able to be, get the agreement to really be able to teach the college course. There's reasons for that, but we want to really make sure we can eliminate those reasons. We want to identify outcome data. We want to make sure that we're collecting, analyzing, and sharing all the programs being offered in the high school, and that we document our progress towards 40-40-20. We want to come back to you in another year or 2 years, and we want to be able to show you how those 100 districts where students don't get any credits is diminished significantly. And then what we do want to do is make sure we continue to support the development of the collaborative relationship. A lot of times this establishes when people in post-secondary get together with people in K-12 and they actually articulate what the standards are, which is a very good thing to do. what the proficiency that is needed in order to count as a course. We've seen wonderful relationships evolve as a result of making sure students get college credit in high school. We wanted to find an equitable funding approach for both K-12 and post-secondary. So you will see that we are suggesting an investment that would give some resources to both the K-12 system and the post-secondary system. So hopefully in front of you, you've received a document that looks like this. And if you look at the backside, this really does articulate for you what is the suggested funding, but I'll go over it briefly. What I want to talk about first is that in dual credit, the funding proposal looks at what we call average daily membership in K-12 and then full-time equivalency in post-secondary. What we want to do, what we've done before already for the people who do it, there's a negotiation between those two K-12 and post-secondary about exactly what does it cost out of each of these pools. And we want to continue to allow those negotiations with a floor of 15% and a ceiling of 90%. And some of this depends on the course, it depends on the teachers, it depends on the cost of the course. What we also know about accelerated learning is that, so if you look at these blue boxes, it would be the second blue box, is that we would do $20 per credit hour, and this would be to get the three accelerated courses. So we're wanting three courses that transfer for every student, and we'd pay $20 per credit hour for the nine college credits or the three courses. In addition to that, there would be an additional $10 for low-income families or students of color. So some of the students we find in our opportunity gap. We also know that books are very expensive. We heard people on the committee talk about that. And so there would be an additional $10 for the first three college courses for CTE, AP or IB, because they are very costly in terms of books or equipment. So that's a little bit about Senate Bill 84, why we think it's critical, what we would achieve, and how much it will cost. And I'll turn it over to Dr. Roselli.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Hilda Roselli. I serve as the Director for College and Career Readiness with the Oregon Education Investment Board, and I had the opportunity to support the legislative task force, the bipartisan legislative task force that Nancy referred to, and did quite a bit of research, talking with folks, getting a better sense of what other states were doing around this important issue. And I think part of this was really driven by the fact that our charge is to pay attention to those transition points. And I thought that it might be helpful to share a few more recent points of data that we've received. And I will reference to all of you that the legislative report that you all received in October has a much more deep analysis of ongoing research that we've been monitoring, but we did receive some new data that we thought would be of interest to you. And I point this out simply to say that if one were to look at the percentage increase of dual credits earned by students, high school students in Oregon, this is done on cohorts and looking at them over time, we might say, oh, well, this is good. This is an uphill trend, but 6% is not very large increase given the importance that we know accompanies when an economy goes down and people start to think, oh, I better really be doing some things here to get ready for the future. What I think is more concerning, though, is that when we took a deeper look with the help of Regional Education Lab Northwest, and we really looked at the race and ethnicity of students who were taking dual credit compared to those who were not taking dual credit, one of our concerns was that there's still a pretty big discrepancy here that we haven't yet addressed. And as Nancy pointed out, that equity lens that we look at everything through calls us to pay attention to this and to say, if we don't really have an equivalent level of students taking coursework to help them move on their pathway, then it behooves us to think about what we can do to increase that pathway for them. We also took a look at what happens for students who are eligible for or have earned free reduced price lunch versus those who have never been eligible for free or reduced price lunch. And I think, you know, just seeing a 14% difference here in the students that are not taking dual credit courses, again, points out a discrepancy for us that we are deeply concerned about. Another way to look at this information is to look at by particular racial and ethnic groups. And I think here we might say, well, you know, our Asian Pacific Islander students, again, this is based on public high school students that are being followed in cohorts. So we're not talking about the entire population of students in our community colleges or four-year institutions. So it's a sample of our high school students who have moved on to community college. And we might say, well, our Asian Pacific Islander students are, you know, even exceeding our white students in terms of taking dual credit. But then when you continue to look at this, you see that that's not an even picture yet. So that is of concern to us. And then we've worked closely throughout this process with groups like the Education Commission of the States, who are looking very carefully at state policy across the nation in this area. And one of their reports that we thought was particularly applicable to Oregon really looks at what happens for our students that are graduating and which ones are likely to enroll in college after they graduate from high school. And I would point out that our lowest number here in the green box with 50% represents our students who are from both a low-income background and from a rural school environment, as compared to 70% of students who are higher income and low minority and urban schools. So again, these are just some ways that we continue to look at discrepancies across the state. As Nancy mentioned, there is a concern also when we look across our state and see that in data that was provided by just recently by Bob Kiern through his ongoing studies of dual credit work that the Oregon University system has done, is that we still have a number of high schools that are not offering anything in the way of dual credit. We've seen numbers ranging from 108 to close to 160. We know some of those include charter schools, but that's an area that we really felt as the committee moved forward that their ideas and recommendations were going to stimulate the kinds of partnerships that would result in more access for students to those courses. So I wanted to leave you with those thoughts and then to move to some amendments that we are presenting to you here. And I will share that the benefit of having had a bipartisan committee focus on this for a full year was that we were able to begin thinking about what draft legislation might look like, and better yet, to be able to vet those recommendations with a wide variety of individuals. And I will say that without turning around, I can tell you there's quite a few people in this room that I've had the privilege of listening to, talking with, and learning from them in terms of their perspectives that they bring to this issue. They are very passionate about the work. In many cases, we saw some differences of views and opinions, but we did benefit from really taking a look at where was there a need for more clarity in the legislative language. And so I'd like to just summarize some of those, particularly around credits, provisions of timelines, online services, and our streamlining processes for partnering. So one of the issues that we really wanted to do was to clean up, and I want to just acknowledge, Chair Roblin, it was your attention to this and some questions that you asked of us in December to really make sure we got the language right, discerning the differences between high school credits that students might earn from like an AP course versus those college college credits, because there's a difference there. And we think we got the language right. We are still taking input on that to make sure that every time there's a reference to credits, that we've got that right. So we certainly are looking forward to any corrections that will improve that. Another concern that was raised was the perception that the legislation was not in favor of providing online services to students to be able to access college credits. Au contraire, we very much believe that that's a viable means. However, the concern that the committee expressed and that is really borne out by opportunities to go and watch even K-12 students now in an online learning environment is that it takes some real motivation and some concerning adult that's present who really kind of moves you along in that work. I know I'm enrolled in a MOOC course, and I have to keep reminding myself to go and take care of that assignment that was due this week. So the concept of having an adult provided to support that person was the language we were looking for, and so we have provided some suggested edits that we think will help with that. There was another concern as we met with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission staff and began to look at the implications for the standards that are already in place, because we certainly would be referencing the work of earlier groups that have established strong evidence of what dual credit standards look like. But we felt like there was some work that the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission would not be able to begin until the fall, when faculty from both the high schools and the community colleges and universities were back. So there is a small edit here in terms of beginning to look at when the timelines would be taking place if this bill were to move forward. There was also a concern that we've gathered from a number of individuals that tell us there is a real unevenness across the state, with some good rationales, but still an unevenness in the timelines and processes that school districts must go through in order to work collaboratively and reach an approval process for a partnership. And so what we've begun to look at there, and looking particularly at evidence from our Project Lead the Way examples, where we looked at, you know, one institution, they're working with 51 high schools trying to approve processes, and we know that's it's a time-consuming event. So we talked about perhaps that a right of first refusal language in the bill would assist districts and community colleges and post-secondary partners to reach an earlier agreement that doesn't slow down the scheduling so dramatically that a whole another year goes by and students don't have access to those courses. Next, we also were really making sure that there was a misunderstanding that this was going to force every student in Oregon to take 9 credits. And I think the word, the opportunity and the access, was what we were really trying to emphasize. So there's some edited language that you'll see there to make sure that it's really about making sure that every student is encouraged to do that, not forced to do that. We also got feedback that, particularly with the diagram that we did to clarify the funding, that people were starting to go, well, is it a this plus this? So maybe that's 18 credits that the funding would pay for. And the notion is no, it's really paying attention to either the first 9 credits of accelerated learning or the first 3 high school credits that a student might earn through AP and IB, whichever occurs first for a student. So that gives the bill language that would make this much easier to figure out and to manage. We also got feedback that was very valuable, and I will take the responsibility that some of my language in summarizing the documents, we in one place and then started to perpetrate that throughout the document, only referred to dual credit. And we really needed to go back and remind ourselves that all the way from the beginning and in the legislative report that you've received, we defined this as accelerated credit options that included several different types of programs, including could apply to some early college programs, some 2+2 perhaps, and not just dual credit. So we would recommend an additional language amendment. You could put that right in the bill, or you could direct the State Board of Education to take care of that. I think the easier way is perhaps to think about an amendment that we could bring to you. And we also really wanted to just close with the fact that we went through the bill again, just made sure that some of the language was the way it needed to be to reflect some of the comments that we received. And we do appreciate the opportunity to continue this work on behalf of Oregon students.
Thank you. Senator Gelfs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your work on this. I have read and reread the bill and had a lot of communications with members of my local school board and my superintendent who have identified this as a bill of great concern that in some way might undermine the good work that our district is doing with a fifth-year college program and the number of kids that we have taking college credits. Can you help me better understand how this bill does that, or how we can protect the good work that our that the kids in my district are benefiting from right now?
Senator Gelser, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee, we couldn't agree with you more about the goodwill and the great intentions that have occurred through the fifth-year program. We actually convened a number of those districts. I believe Corvallis might have been at that meeting to learn more about how they were doing that program and the benefits that were incurred for students and the motivations and ways that we might be able to address that at a time when we were also aware that that is coming out of a general school fund, state school fund, in a way that if it were to be adopted on a large scale, would really nullify any increases that you would be looking at for the state school fund. In other words, right now, those dollars are paying for that fully, and we really believe that there are some other solutions. And there's actually a bill that is Senate Bill 322, in which there is going to be some suggested amendments that will address how could we transition the good work of the, we think it's 10 to 12 districts that have been using that model to help them do what they really want to do, which is to help students access those college courses without holding back the diploma and without relying solely on that state school fund for a fifth year while a student is enrolled.
Can I just follow up?
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that challenge. I just wonder if we really are talking about a system that's a P-20 system, and we're talking about students succeeding, it's hard for me to imagine breaking apart something that has increased our high school graduation rate by double digits in our school district. And I don't know how I could go back and look at those families and look at those students and say, sorry, we tried this, it worked out really well, but you're in the wrong silo, so we're not going to do it anymore, and then watch those high school graduation rates plummet after that.
Senator Gelser and Senator Roblin and members of the committee, I would like to offer that there are some other scenarios that can achieve this work, and that I believe that the idea of a transition for the fifth-year program is a way that would help districts that have made an initial commitment to families to make good on those commitments. However, one of the things that has been really intriguing for a number of people that have been looking closely at a model in Texas that has every demographic characteristic that you would expect to see in some of our districts where we have the greatest discrepancy of access. And yet one of the things that we've seen is that because they consciously and systemically began looking at the supports that need to happen for students much earlier than 11th grade, they have actually seen skyrocketing improvements, not only in graduation rates, but in the number of credits the students earn during the 4 years of high school. And so what we've been looking at is systematically, you have to look at placement tests. You have to look at when does a student have access to that. You have to look at the advising supports. You have to look at building that college-going culture very early. And right now, one of our concerns is that so often what happens is that the major focus is happening once a student maybe gets into 11th grade and then in 12th grade and then 13th grade. We think that needs to happen much earlier, maybe even as early as 8th grade, when students begin to see, well, where am I in my college career readiness, and what am I going to need to do? How do I get access to the skills I need for that?
And Mr. Chair, I would just add, that is happening, and in our districts it is starting earlier, and I appreciate the concern and the policy question about how does the money flow, but I look at the kids in my district, I don't understand why we would go back and try to recreate or build a brand new system when we have something that clearly works, it's not broken,
and
change it?
And we'll have a bigger conversation about that, because if every school did the fifth-year program, then no school would have the advantage that they have now, and the amount of money per student for our general distribution would go down, and all schools would be hurt. And right now, it's helping the few that are doing it, and we have to look at the whole system and whether we retain it. And I think that's a conversation we'll have with our other bill. So.
And I would just add, if we didn't have the fifth-year programs in Corvallis and Albany and Philomath, we would have hundreds of kids without high school diplomas today. And I think the net benefit to the state of having those kids graduated from high school and moving on to college, I don't want to take it away from them. I
understand what you're saying.
Thank you. I'm not sure if we're talking about the same thing on this fifth-year deal. If you're talking about, we had a hearing before you came over here, Senator Gelser, on fifth and sixth years, where some school districts are offering kids the ability to stay on for a year or two extra, so that they can take their K-12 ADMW money and use it for community colleges.
That's our program.
And the problem with that is it's all 100% state money. You're not accessing any of the federal grants. That's the problem. The heart is well-intended, but as Senator Roblin pointed, if Portland did that or Salem-Keizer did that, it'd swamp the boat, and we wouldn't be able to afford it. And so that's one of the arguments for the free community college, because as soon as that becomes available, that would make this question moot. We're not talking about fifth and sixth year programs for kids who are sick or, you know, didn't finish up in time. We're talking about taking K-12 money and spending it on community college, because that's really what that is. There's probably a dozen or so districts that do that now, and their hearts are in the right places, that's for sure. And I applaud them for doing that. But we had testimony from the Gaston superintendent over the summer who came down and said, yeah, we just started doing this. Ethically, we know it's a challenge, but we have to provide some opportunities for some of these kids who used to go to the lumber mills after high school a generation ago, and now that's not available.
And I would just clarify, it's not just the money. I mean, there are additional supports that are being given to these kids. They wouldn't be successful without the types of supports that K-12 school district is providing them as they make that transition. So it's not just a grab for the money. So I will stop. I just know that I've gotten a lot of communication from my district.
It just means we have to have a 13th year in our K-12 system, so all people can access that and use it in a different way. And that has a cost that may not be bearable in the system as a whole. So that's part of the whole thing. Senator Batchelor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Golden, this is about your third time that you've spoke to us this year, and I understand the concept, and I definitely have to check with my superintendents to see how it'll blend. But one thing that I'm really disturbed about is we're always talking about college, college, college. How about that large group of kids that wants to leave high school and go into the workplace? What are we doing for them?
Senator Buttigieg, Senator Roblin, thank you. That's a really important question and actually something we've been very, very focused on. What we say is everyone leaves high school with a college or career skills. We know many kids will go right into the workforce. We believe career technical education is really one avenue and very important. That's why we've suggested an investment in it. We do want them to leave with skills, so if they ever choose to go back, whether it's to a community college to get a certificate a license or a transfer degree, that they have the skills to do that. So we did suggest an investment in career technical education just because of this. More of that in the high school, because we don't want kids dropping out. And we know some kids really engage with career technical education so they can take a course or two, get the license, get the certificate, and go into the workforce. So we're very much aligned with that.
Okay.
Any other questions for these two? Thank you very much. And our time is growing shorter, and we have a fairly long list of people who would like to speak. So so let's bring up the Oregon Education Association Community College Council, Tracy Hodgson, Jody Marion, and Susan Huffman. And then I'm going to try to get my, if I can, my people from over 100 miles away. And then we'll go from there. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Tracy Hodgson. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a history instructor at Chemeketa Community College in Salem. I'm the president of the Chemeketa Faculty Association and the secretary of the Oregon Education Association Community College Council, which represents approximately 3,500 community college faculty across the state. In this panel, you hear three experienced college and high school educators who will offer serious suggestions about how to improve Senate Bill 84, so the dual credit options in Oregon will give students a true college experience they deserve. Community college faculty are eager to help expand dual credit programs to prepared high school students in Oregon. So to assist in that effort, the OEA Community College Council produced a white paper on dual credit, which has been submitted for the record. I'll quickly summarize some points, and then you can read them in greater detail. Those dual credit courses that provide the students with authentic college educational experience are the most effective in transitioning high school students into successful college careers. The following models that best facilitate this are expanding opportunities for students to go onto college campuses to take classes, take college online courses with the support of a high school mentor, providing opportunities for qualified college faculty to come into the high schools to teach, expanding AP and IB programs to increase student access to quality credit, expanding existing dual credit programs that are already in place by providing resources to high school teachers to get the graduate education they need to teach college courses. Senate Bill 84, currently written, does not ensure the adoption of effective quality dual credit. A stronger bill would call on the OEIB to implement and facilitate all of those programs I just mentioned, and also utilize the educational expertise of high school educators and college educators, perhaps creating a dual credit task force where they could give their insight into what will work for students and what is college level quality. Most importantly, a stronger bill would have quality controls and accountability that must be built into any new dual credit program to assure that colleges can legitimately accept this credit and know that it's something that is the equivalent of a college experience. Finally, a new program should be required to meet the standards developed by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships. It's called NACEP, and it is the collective wisdom of educators around the nation about what constitutes a quality dual credit program. So community college faculty in Oregon are dedicated to providing access to well-prepared students, and we look forward to working with you and others in that respect. Now I'll turn it over to the other speakers, and then we'll be welcome to answer questions.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Huffman. I live in Tualatin, and I teach at North Marion High School in Aurora. Last summer, I was instructed by my administrators to attend the Willamette Promise kickoff at Central High School, where we were given an overview of the program, and then we were sent to our subject areas to learn more about the specific subject area, and I went to the writing one. I left the meeting frustrated, kind of angry, and very dumbfounded by what I'd heard. I'm in my 28th year of full-time teaching. The last 20 have been with upperclassmen. I've taught junior English, I've taught senior English, I've taught SAT prep, I've taught college prep workshops, and I've taught college writing. Through these positions, I think I have a very, very good idea of what my students need to be successful in college. The Willamette Promise didn't meet those needs at all. It didn't even come close to them. Because of that, I went back to my administrators and asked that I please not have to do the Willamette Promise and that I could stay with the CCN program at Chemeketa where the kids' needs were being met. I'm not opposed to dual credit programs. but I am opposed to dual credit programs that set my students up for failure and that send them off to college with this false idea that they can do college work because they passed three work samples or two work samples. The expectations should be the same for college students as they are for high school students. College credit classes should be hard. College classes are hard. For the Willamette Promise, the Writing 121 and 122 expectations were that the kids would write two essays in a class of an hour. They had an hour for each essay, and then they were to polish one essay, and then they were to write a reflective essay on those two. That would earn them four college credits. There is no college I know of that allows students to do that and earn four college credits. And I don't want my students set up like that. The idea of embedding writing assignments into any high school class, any high school English class, is ludicrous. We have our own curriculum that we need to teach, and it's aligned with the Common Core standards. I can't just take a college writing class and say, here, write a couple essays, and then send those kids off and say that they have met the requirements. It doesn't work like that. I teach college writing in my college writing classes. I teach senior English in my senior English classes. They are entirely different. Those students are entirely different, and their abilities are entirely different. My students need instruction. They need practice. They need guidance. They need a teacher with a curriculum for college. They need college-level textbooks. They need access to computers. They need to learn how to use databases. And probably the most important is that they need to work very, very hard. If a dual credit program supports those needs, then I think it is a good program. If it doesn't, it's hurting our kids, not helping them.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Marion, and I teach writing at Mount Hood Community College in Gresham, Oregon, where I work on the dual credit work group. I'm also a member of the statewide committee called OEAC, which sets the English curricula for the state of Oregon in higher education. Through working with my colleagues, we've learned a number of things through our classroom experience and research, that while these whole and middle college accelerated learning opportunities have been very beneficial for students, we have nothing but concern for the proficiency-based models such as the Oregon Promise, and I'd like to share just a few of those concerns with you. First, keeping students in a year-long cycle for a college course when a college course is only 10 weeks in duration gives the students a false sense of the pace of college work, and as my colleague mentioned here, it kind of sets them up for a false sense of security or confidence for when they go to college or university. It calls into question the whole notion of acceleration and accelerated learning. Second, students who don't leave their high school campuses fail to benefit from some of the crucial elements of a college education, for example, encountering diversity of thoughts, paradigm shifts. Foregoing these sorts of things really inhibit critical thinking. And third, when limited to a high school campus, students don't have access to college-level libraries or library instruction. So this can hamper them in meeting the information literacy outcome that is required in first-year composition. Other services such as tutoring from the Writing Center may also not be available to them. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the lack of consistent statewide course quality guidelines for accelerated learning really endangers the quality and equity among the various institutions that are offering accelerated learning opportunities. And without guidelines based on best practices, how can we really ensure that students who receive these credits are prepared for college-level work? So today, I'm asking you to please consider the dramatic differences between accelerated learning programs that take students to college campuses and those who leave students on the high school campus. If you find that you're still not able to oppose Senate Bill 84, I ask that an oversight committee with stronger protections inside Senate Bill 84 would be established that would ensure accelerated learning programs maintain the rigor and dynamic of authentic college courses. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for this group? Senator Hess.
Thank you. I just wanted to I guess, comment that these issues came up in the task force that Dr. Golden chaired, and they were pretty well, I thought, worked out. And the report that's embodied in this legislation passed that task force unanimously, and rigor was a big part of a year's worth of work on this. That task force had a number of legislators, Democrats and Republicans, who passed it unanimously. And so I'm not sure where the disconnect is, if you weren't represented in the task force or why you weren't, but this issue came up. The bill is not the Willamette Promise or the Oregon Promise or the Eastern Oregon Promise or anything. This is actual language. Mm-hmm. And those, I think the safeguards are built in place. And I haven't seen you point to sections or provisions or language where your complaints are based, other than in notions on these Eastern Oregon Promises. This is not the Eastern Oregon Promise. I'm not backing away from that. I'd like to emulate the success they had, but this is different because it's pinned down in actual proposed law. So I would ask that you keep working with us and try to make this better, and perhaps we can incorporate some of the issues to address your concerns. But to come in and to criticize the Eastern Oregon Promise as, you know, what's wrong with this bill, I'm not sure if I'm tracking that.
I believe this bill could create an Eastern Oregon Promise that could go statewide. We would want more safeguards, and there are some safeguards built in the bill. We'd like to see more.
Thank you very much. We're going to try to get all the people who had to take a day off from work and others today. It may go a little over 45. So next we have Kevin Fury, Marla Edge, Lita Colligan. And Allie, you're on deck, so, because I know you have left a day of school to be here, and we appreciate that.
Lita's not testifying.
Oh, okay. So Allie, you can come on up. And however you want to start. I think there's only one other person who we haven't had that's over 100 miles, and that's Jeff. Is it Dents? And we'll have that person. Oh, yeah. Thanks. We'll have you give it a shot. Go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Senator Roblin.
Try to keep it to like 2 minutes each, so okay. keep it as short as you can. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
As short as you can, just okay. So we get everybody's testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knapp, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marla Edge. I am the Director of Academic Agreements for Oregon Tech. In my job, I'm responsible for approving, monitoring, and tracking accelerated credit relationships and articulations for Oregon Tech with over 50 high school and community college partners. I've been involved with dual credit administration for over 15 years and directly responsible for Oregon Tech's program for a decade. I have actively participated in discussions with the Accelerated Credit Task Force as they work to develop this bill. In addition to monitoring the committee work and testifying, I have met with the HEC and OEIB staff. I did this in my position as chair of the Dual Credit Oversight Committee, which I've served on since its inception, and also as a member of the Oregon Dual Credit Coordinators Group. I also serve on the board of Oregon Association for Career and Technical Education, and I'm a member and past president of the Oregon Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers. I mention those because those two groups are closely involved with multiple types of accelerated credit. Personally, dual credit and smooth student transitions are my passion and what my work life is centered on. I'm speaking today, however, on behalf of all seven of Oregon's public universities. Oregon's public universities support Senate Bill 84 and will work together with our high school and community college partners to ensure that all of Oregon's students have access to accelerated college credit before they leave high school. The universities collaborated on a letter that we submitted to the committee that describes our shared commitment to accelerated credit. There is a lot of research on accelerated credit that demonstrates its effectiveness at increasing the number of students who are well prepared for a college experience and encouraging a college-going culture among high school students. We applaud this work as an effective student success strategy. I've really seen that increase the last few years, and I compliment the state and rulemakers for heading that up. The letter from the seven universities also lists some specific recommendation for changes to the bill that would address concerns expressed by our university provosts and vice presidents for academics. You have received the detailed input in this letter, so I'm just going to stress a couple points in my comments today. There are some copies for the gallery available in the back also. First, we respectfully suggest that the process for teacher-faculty collaboration and the approving of qualified teachers remain in the domain of our faculty under the leadership of our provost. Each university has a unique set of programs, accrediting agencies, and faculty-led curriculum guided by the principles of shared governance and academic freedom. Each public university has a process for aligning course outcomes and for approving teachers in alignment with its program accreditation and institutional accreditation standards. In fact, the post-secondary institutions have more flexibility to improve qualified teachers than the community colleges because the standards are not in statute, and we base our acceptance of teachers on teacher experience, educational background, course content, and a variety of other factors. Each institution must work with its faculty and its accrediting agencies and establish a culture of collaboration and support for accelerated credit. National dual credit standards, which the last speakers talked about, are developed and monitored by the National Alliance for Concurrent Enrollment, which the Oregon dual credit standards are modeled on. They require that the high school faculty qualifications to teach dual credit be the same as the post-secondary institution transcribing the college credit. In order to offer dual credit in Oregon, our colleges and universities must be certified as meeting these and other rigorous standards. We respectfully request that those two subsections in Section 5 that are cited in our letter be deleted from the bill. The letter expresses some limitations for online course delivery, especially because it may be limited for rural students. As Dr. Roselli pointed out, we understand that an amendment to this section is in the works and are very appreciative about that. Additionally, an item that's been discussed a little bit today is timeliness. I just came from a dual credit oversight committee meeting this morning. A concern that all of us who do this work share involves timing. It's an extremely complex undertaking, this bill is, with many parts. We urge a slow rollout that allows for piloting and thoughtful partner negotiations. To do otherwise would be chaotic and perhaps would sabotage our efforts. I'd like to just point out just one more thing. Oregon Tech has a history of providing accelerated college credit. Among our current efforts, we are leaders of the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership, a collaboration of 15 school districts, Clackamas, Chemeketa, and Portland Community Colleges, four universities, and many industry and community partners. We are all working to catalyze student preparation for an engagement in STEM career paths.
Hurry up and whatever, because we've only got 1 minute or 2 minutes for the other two people. So,
okay. One of our key strategies is the expansion of STEM dual credit. Our efforts are working well, but we fear the work could be hindered by some of the provisions of this bill.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Ali Hyerson, and I'm here briefly just to support the Bill 84. I currently go to Portland Community College, and I'm a student who benefits from dual enrollment and dual credit. I was here invited by Senator Haas to just give a brief testimony about why I support this bill. So basically, to talk about the program I'm in, I'm at Portland Community College in the Gateway to College program. This program basically takes high school dropout students. It's not traditionally a dual enrollment program since it doesn't focus on giving dual credits to students who are already in high school. It focuses on helping students who drop out of high school or are on the risk of dropping out of high school. Unfortunately, I was enrolled into a private high school that did not have credits, and by the time I was ready to enroll into public high school, I didn't have that opportunity, and I dropped out. Through the Gateway to College program at Portland Community College, I was able to have a second chance at chasing after my dreams, and through this program, I will have my associates completely paid for, and I also will be able to earn my high school diploma. So I really support dual enrollment and dual credits. By the end of this, I will probably only have to pay about $900 for my associate's degree rather than almost $20,000. So it's a very wonderful program. I'm very grateful for the program. It's helping me to be relieved of financial burden as well as my parents from paying any tuition debt that I would be in because of this program. So other than that, I support this bill, and I thank you for letting me be able to testify on that.
Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon, Senator Roblin and the rest of the committee. My name is Dr. Kevin Fury. I am a resident of Bend. I am a economics instructor at Chemeketa Community College, and I was the community college faculty advisor to the State Board of Education in 2012 to 2014. I am in favor of expanding dual credit, but I am against the bill as currently written. I think I'll limit my discussion to responding somewhat to Senator Haas, in that the idea of expanding dual credit is to get more students to be able to successfully transition from high school into college. And of course, the more authentic the dual credit classes can be towards college courses, the better. Now, looking at the bill itself, in the bill, it gives the Oregon Investment Board, Educational Investment Board, the ability to choose what are the highest quality courses. Currently, the Investment Board has been promoting Eastern Promise and its replication grants, but there's a fear out there because of the fact that these particular programs have built-in incentives in them that bias the outcomes towards granting more credits at the expense of quality education, that there's a fear that they're not going to be sufficient college rigor in these classes. In the bill itself, there's a couple of other incentives built in which exacerbate this. One is that in the bill, payment to the high schools and to the four-year institutions is given for credits passed, not credits taken. So that gives an incentive to put pressure on people to make sure that people pass. Also in the bill, it allows high schools to shop around for that school that will give them the easiest path to getting credits. And on the other side, once you allow shopping around, that also allows four-year institutions to aggressively market themselves. We would hope that what would be true in this bill is that the one section would be amended so that there would be a list of acceptable dual credit programs which the OEIB could choose from, and we would hope that the Eastern Promise would either not be an option there or would be limited only to those cases where nothing else would work. Thank you for allowing me the question.
Thank you. We are now 10 minutes over our time, and we have another committee coming in here. So we are, if you have and can't come back, I think there's one person that's over 100 miles, please leave written testimony. Otherwise, we will be having a hearing to finish up the people that are left on this committee. So we will carry over Senate Bill 84. And we will also, I'll close that public hearing on Senate Bill 84. We'll also carry over Senate Bill 518. And is there any other issues that people want to come before us? Seeing none, we are going to adjourn our meeting of the Senate Education Committee.
Such a wonderful thing.
Did you manage to find that chart? I apologize.
Such a wonderful thing.
Did you manage to find that chart? I apologize.